You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. So here's what Lacrosse has recently done. They've taken their 100 plus years of experience to create a new line of lace-up hunting boots called the Navigator Series. Now, the Navigator Series comes in two options, the Atlas for men and the Windrose for both men and women. Now, if you want to find out more about their high-quality awesome boots, you need to go to lacrossefootwear.com.
Hey guys, welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. This is your host, Adam Keith. We're co-owners of a consulting company called, go figure, Land and Legacy. This is your number one podcast resource for all things land.
Each week, we're breaking down topics from land management, habitat management, conservation, farming practices, and real estate. We hope you guys enjoy it.
Well, welcome back, guys, to another Land Lakes podcast. It's Adam here.
And Matt's here.
And we're going to get back on track.
Can you believe it?
You really can't even wrap your head around.
We're already August 4th.
This is going to air August the 6th, I believe, which puts it just a month and a week away from opening of Missouri deer season, archery season. It's insane.
Does
Tennessee's got that early?
Tennessee opens up like the 24th, 5th, and 6th, what? I think, for that early archery deal, which is like, that's 20 days away.
Yeah.
Here's the thing that always gets me, and I know that there's a lot of people out there, probably people who are listening, that like your mind's always focused on deer season. And I don't think ours is focused on deer season. It's more like just preparing for general fall, but it always sneaks up. It's like, oh my gosh, it's August, and I could potentially have a bow in my hand in a month. And it's like, I'm not ready for that. I'm just not. It's still like very much summertime feel, but now as these pictures and these bucks that we're watching are developing, it's like, man, it is legit getting real.
For
it's
sure.
Coming quick.
Yeah, we had a couple deer. We've had these couple really nice deer on camera, but then Chad went and checked another property that we hunt, and one of them that's had many encounters. had a couple of shots at him.
Over the past, what, 2 years?
2 years, I think, yeah. 2 years ago, I shot at him with a muzzleloader, and he was just too far, I think, and Chad shot at him last year.
400 yards.
Yeah. When I shot at him, I think he was like 130 yards, but it was like way last light.
There's snow on the ground.
There was snow on the ground.
It was legal hours, so it was just really cloudy.
Yeah, and then Chad shot him last year, but he's the deer we had nicknamed Snakes.
Good reason why.
Because it was kind of what people call him, cactus deer, so he's kind of had that cactus antlers, and he was he's a great deer. He's back. There's another nice deer with him, so there's a lot of excitement, a lot of deer to chase.
Well, and truthfully, y'all just pulled for the first time cameras on, there's been the lease that the cutting link is basically set up on, but then your guys' like home farm, family farm,
it's just,
Chad just recently pulled out this weekend, and lo and behold, there's another deer there that's like,
that
holy
we believe
cow.
We had an encounter with last year.
Fantastic encounter.
And, you know, I don't know how old he is, but he made a great jump.
Unreal. Unreal jump, really.
So he's definitely on the hit list. Definitely a deer we won't pass up.
Was he a 9 last year or 8?
I thought he was just an 8.
He was a basic, spindly horn.
Barely
wide,
any brows.
Yes. A decently wide deer, probably 17 and a half or so. Last year, and it's like, wow, that deer's, he's young, he's great. He walked in front of you, what was that, late October? One morning, late October,
somewhere there.
30 yards, strolled him by. We actually watched him bed down and took pictures of him bedded down in a thicket, and it's like, huh, cool. And then he pops up this year, and like, hello. Now, that's the same deer, but that's a game changer, that jump that he made.
For sure. So, this podcast is devoted to last-minute techniques and habitat improvements to not only make this season more successful, but future seasons more successful. And this is kind of the thought process and the mindset that will help you understand our philosophy And it's, you know, it's ironic. Lately, we've had a lot of really nice emails. Did the podcast last week with Steve in North Carolina, and we had a ton of emails and private messages where guys were wanting to sign up to have their property right. evaluated. And we'll have another one coming in the future. But a lot of people saying that they like that their mindset and their eyes, the way they look at their property, have changed since listening mm-hmm. to our podcast. So we know we're doing some good.
Truthfully, I don't think there's a bigger compliment than that in and of itself, because here we are, we're talking through land management every single week in a podcast. We're not able to get to everyone's property or be with everyone on their own property, but through just listening and hopefully absorbing this information, it's changing the way people then go to their property and look at it. Like, you couldn't ask for anything more out of a podcast, I think, than that right there. And as long as you guys are out there trying to actively change and observe things and think critically about it, you guys are then going to take that action and really create some awesome habitat across the country.
Absolutely. And not only change some habitat right away, but change it for the long term good. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully educate others around you to do the same thing. And so, you know, that's the thing, is some of these techniques you're going to probably think were crazy, but one of the best deer on the Prairie Hollow property right now is living around a food plot we call Paradise Point. Well, just
2 days
ago, yeah. we went in and did edge feathering. You and Chad, I was working on some other projects. You guys did edge feathering. You did bedding thickets. You created yep. two bedding thickets, and you edge feathered that whole side that he's been coming out on the most.
Yep.
Completely changed that area.
I mean, we ran a chainsaw for probably 3.5 to 4 hours in the area. And, you know, if you go back and you probably listen to all sorts of other podcasts and this and that and read articles and pages, like, that's a humongous no-no pretty much in a lot of people's opinion. This close to season, don't do any disturbance. Mature buck, he's going to leave completely. That deer's been in there and using that area for years.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a concern at all.
And, other thing is, like, what was created was the best habitat in the neighborhood.
Period.
So,
bar none. In that short amount of time.
If you think about it, here's the mindset, and you'll see some of our videos on social media, a couple cell phone videos we shot while we were out there. We don't manage for a specific buck. We don't manage for a specific species. We manage for all native species that are in that area for their benefit. So what we're doing is replicating nature's natural cycle, or trying to replicate it. You may be wondering, how does chainsaw have to do with any of this? But with edge feathering...
Hang with us for a little bit.
Edge feathering, what we're really trying to replicate is the way... our landscape, Southern Missouri, shaped by fire. That was one of the biggest disturbances that we had that shaped it and created the diversity in the mosaic habitat. What we're doing with our edge feathering is we're going in and trying to feather the edge, obviously, with chainsaws the way the fire did pre-settlement. So fire, as it swept across the landscape, we're talking vast wildfires. They would then go rip through an open area, and then if there was a forest, they would hit that edge to where you would get this flame heights going from grasses, from grasslands to more of dropping down because the fuel type changed, and so you had this kind of sporadic changing transition from one habitat type to another, and so the edge was more of a soft step down. A step down transition, and that's what we're creating with edge feathering. So there's the habitat benefit as far as our
multiple species
restoration.
Yeah.
Now there's more. There's going to be more sunlight on the edge, so the food plot is not competing with a thicket of mature trees. So the food plot edges are going to do better, but also there's going to be more stump sprouts, so there's more shrubby component, young forest component. So deer standing 50 yards in the timber can't see all the way into the food plot, So it helps from a beneficial side of now there's woody browse available during the winter months. There's woody browse available during the whole growing season. But it also protects. So if you're hunting the edge of the food plot, you could grunt and try to lure deer out in it because they can't see standing back in the timber 50 yards. They can't see what deer are out in the food plot. So a huge benefit there. But probably the biggest is the fact that now we can steer deer closer to tree stands to where that. What do you think that edge of that food plot is? It ends up being about almost 2 acre food plot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a big square.
Pretty much square.
And it's probably 75, 80 yards,
easy.
That north side. And deer could come out anywhere through it. But now it's edge feathered to where there's really only 20 yards that they could go through on that north side, which they were coming out in a spot about 20 yards from the gap that we opened up. But we closed up that area with hinging trees, and I would say this is probably our most popular time of using hinge cuts,
yeah,
is in edge feathering.
Well, and we talked about on Insta story and this and that if you guys are watching, but this is the fine tooth comb stuff where you can get into more, let's say, detailed work with a chainsaw where, yes, you are legit steering deer. We're getting these deer to move where they're coming in and out of this food plot 20 yards, and sometimes that may be asking a lot. We'll get into the other aspect that kind of helps dictate where they're coming out at in a second. But the reason we had to do it is because there wasn't a stand option. There wasn't a tree that we could go and hang in and access with the right winds and everything where they're certainly coming out at right now. So we had to change something, and we closed off an area. We improved the habitat. And now, by design, hopefully we're going to see that entry and exit point of where those deer are coming in and out of the food plot change to an area where we can easily slip in and kill them. And I, you know, we're not going in with the mindset of that running a chainsaw is going to take the place of prescribed fire, and you know, we're gonna have the exact same disturbances, but by golly, we're gonna have a heck of a lot better habitat, and we're gonna have a lot, maybe not the exact same species component, but the same general type of feathered transitional edge from food plot to our mature timber. So we're going for the same things, just going a different way about it. So
that's why,
all in all, it improves the habitat and improves the hunting. So I don't see why you would never just go ahead and do it.
And when you think about all the practices, habitat management practices, this might take the cake for me on the one that could be used to improve the habitat, but also improve the hunting just as much if used correctly.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this is where you won't hear us recommend edge feathering a lot on these podcasts where we do consultation, like interviews. Now, once again, those interviews like we did last week, they don't take the place of a consultation. They're nowhere near as much information as we give on a consultation. But at the same time, edge feathering is so fine-tooth comb that it's hard to recommend it when you've never seen the property.
It is so detail-oriented of terrain, topography,
species,
again, access,
of trees,
yeah, exactly.
Size of trees.
100%. You just can't go to every edge or design a food plot and then say we're going to edge feather this side. You know, because you could easily have,
we're
going to
close edge feather,
yeah,
this side.
DBH, you know, great white oaks that might drop, or other species that you're like, oh, I don't want to destroy all that. Like, you cannot achieve that in a podcast where you're looking at a map. We all know that, but it's still one of those things that you have to use your discretion because you're on site and just be smart about it. It's common sense, truthfully, of what am I going to do with this chainsaw that's going to help improve the habitat and the hunting.
Yeah.
Each tree you cut, it's a decision. Yes or no, keep it or leave it. And, you know, opening up that transition zone, more sunlight, more species, it's going to help the hunting.
For sure. So edge feathering, big thing. You know, we're gonna try to drive this home. There's a big deer in the area, and it may, for a short period, push him to it. We had pictures of him that night.
Oh, yeah.
Down in the bottom.
Not terribly far. I mean, truthfully, off the slope, down in the bottom.
Yeah.
It's not that far.
Not very far, less than a mile. Less than a half a mile away.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, we could have bumped him out of the area. You guys could have went in there that afternoon when you first stepped in it and bumped him out of bed. Who cares? What we're doing is creating better habitat for the long term. And because the habitat is so poor in our area, as well as most of the country, other than
everyone's raising their hand right now.
You guys out in Kansas, Oklahoma, where it's native prairie, and we're all jealous and envious of you.
Yeah.
Most of us have poor habitat. And so basically we're creating a vacuum effect where now we have the best habitat in that part of the world, especially on that ridge, to where it's like, well, we know deer are going to come back and utilize this. Some of the sassafras that were cut, they already have their berries formed on them. Mm-hmm. We're putting food on the ground. A lot of those trees have young little leaves
for
lots of wildlife. Ends of twigs.
It's not, it's not just deer.
Yeah, bears are going to love it.
Yeah.
By the way, Nogi? I have seen a lot of bears, a lot of sassafras in the last week.
Bent over?
Limbs broken or bent over, and you may think, what in the world? Probably bears.
Yep.
And so, you know, the edge feathering is doing so much for the deer, for the turkeys, for the bear.
For rabbits.
If you're in an area where you have quail or you have grouse, this is great for them as well.
No doubt.
And so great for the rabbits, like you said. And so, yeah, this is a huge win. And it's one of those things that this time of year, if you're trying to create an edge and you're trying to create a visual barrier as well as an actual physical barrier, what better time than do it when there's actual leaves on the tree? This is, I would prefer to do edge feathering now rather than in the winter. Now, we do a lot of edge feathering in the winter, but if you're dropping these trees, you're creating just a wall of leaves, and if you've hinged the trees, they're going to stay on there. And so now you've got this great barrier that's only going to help your hunting. So, huge win.
And that's the thing, you know, the next thing we're going to talk about is basically a bedding thicket that was created, a wildlife opening just off the slope of this food plot. And all the edge feathering, the open edge feathering, closed edge feathering, the tree stand placement, the access, and then this bedding thicket where we know deer are generally bedding at within this larger drain kind of complex, we're now isolating and creating this better habitat off the edge of the food plot. That makes sense the way when a deer stands up out of that bedding thicket, the easiest place for them to walk, they've already made the decision as they're standing up of how they're accessing that food plot. And it is by design, by the edge feathering, by the placement of the bedding thicket, it's designed that it's the easiest path straight up the hill right to basically 20-yard chip shot in front of this tree stand. Those are the types of things that if you are understanding how deer utilize terrain and habitat features on a property, no, it's not bulletproof. They're not going to do it absolutely 100% of the time. But a large percentage of the time, they're going to read scripts. And we've seen it happen over the past couple of years of deer just absolutely reading a script in a time period, let's say the rut, when things tend to be very chaotic and they're just traveling around like crazy. It's just understanding what deer naturally do then and having a property set up in the way that it needs to be set up based on, again, habitat features, topography changes, you're going to get in front of deer. And that's like, it's almost giddy. Like, it's super hot running a chainsaw right now this time of the year. You're sweating like crazy, but it's exciting as you're doing it and you're out there in the field implementing this stuff because you're like, I can totally see this happening. Like, I can see this hunt coming together and I'm drenched in sweat early August, but come October,
see,
late October,
crawling.
Yeah, it's like, it's going to happen. I just need the right weather and the right wind to be able to access it, and it totally can happen, totally. And that's the thing I think about as this Prairie Hollow property develops, there's not going to be a place on it that's not, you're just super confident going to. You know what I mean? Like, super confident any time of the year, you can go and hunt it, and it be, you're in the ballgame.
Yeah.
There's not like the throwaway sets, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, gosh, this could be good.
Yeah.
This could be really good.
And it's definitely, the more we fine-tune and look at the, because going back, the Prairie Hollow property has been mainly just hunted since Chad and I first started hunting it in 2004, I believe. No, take that back. We first started hunting it right around 2000.
Mm-hmm.
It changed ownership in 2004, 2005. And then we started actually, that was just hunting. We started actually managing it 2 years ago.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
so that started the logging operation, which hasn't done a whole lot. We've done a couple main areas, but for the most part,
what you mean is not that it's not done a lot, but it's not all the way completed or close to completion.
We're not even a quarter of the way between.
It's impacted
what we're gonna
a
do.
Lot, but it hasn't. You know, there's still a large percentage that needs to get accomplished.
Well, and 4 or 5 years ago, we didn't even have one mature deer on camera at all on that whole 600 acres. Tell you how bad it was. Now we've got a deer that's probably pushing 160 and another one that pushing 150.
And how bad it was from two different aspects. Habitat one, but two,
terrible
hunting pressure and age structure within the greater herd.
Yeah.
It was like non-existent.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's come a long ways and the habitat's been poor. Now there's been logging, bunch mm-hmm. of woodland restoration. We've shared pictures on our social media about how wonderful it looks. And a little side note on that, we did that woodland restoration. We've shared pictures with you guys. We've talked about it. It's about 90 acres or that section. It's probably a 60-acre cut. Big blue stems popping under large oaks, and it's now 6 foot tall with seeds all over it, seed heads forming. It's like, where were you? Just laying in this. It was just laying in the on the ground going, please, Lord, send a fire mm-hmm. through here or a tornado so I
Give
can get some
sun
sunlight.
Give me fire, baby.
Yeah, and it got that, and now it's just gone nuts. And I noticed yesterday, 2 days ago, driving through a big clump in an area I didn't know there was any blue stem. And it's just like, that's only going to spread.
I will say this about that little slope. It has more than exceeded expectations in 2 years of what it has come to be.
Yeah.
By far. And this is only year two.
Indian grass hadn't even started growing a whole lot in there yet.
There's a little bit right off the road.
Yeah.
It's like, that's just the start. Just wait.
Yeah.
First
saw
fire.
Joe Pye weed growing. Yep. It just is
wild.
Crazy. And so that's a great area. But this area we're talking about, up until the edge feathering bedding thicket was put in place, if you were to say from 100 yards from this food plot, the food plot's been the only thing that's changed
mm-hmm.
other than trees getting a little bigger and a little bit more shade on the ground in the last 30 years, basically.
Yeah.
And now you guys cut out that north slope. You cut out the south slope probably 200 yards from
mm-hmm.
there, did the edge feathering. So now it's like, wow, there's going to be woody browse available. There's going to be a lot more native herbaceous plants in the timber. Burned it. We have burned it in the past, but like we've said so much, burning closed canopy forest really doesn't do a lot.
There was nothing really beneficial on the ground, truthfully.
Yeah. We knocked some sassafras back, which I noticed when we cut had only stump sprouted even harder.
Well, we cut a lot of little saplings.
Yeah. And so, you know, edge feathering.
Yep.
Do it. Don't be scared. Do it right now. If there's if you're scared, hey, man, I never got around to that. Should I do it? Should I not do it? Do it. Who cares? It's only temporary bumping deer out of the area. Do the improvement, and deer will notice the improvement in the habitat and take it to their advantage. So you're adding woody browse to the ground. You're adding cover to the ground. You're bringing more sunlight to the ground. You know, Matt, I was thinking a lot lately. How many times we talk limited resource this, limited resource that. There's limited cover. There's limited food. There's limited security.
Everything's limited.
When are we going to just sum it up in one thing and say, for the most part, if you're in timber country, the limited resource is sunlight to the ground? Because just by getting that to the ground, you're going to get change.
You will definitely have change. And here's species composition. If you have very poor underbrush, sometimes you don't know what's going to come back. You don't. There's indicators out there, this and that, across the whole country. But if you go out there and you just open up the canopy, allow sunlight in, you're going to get, whether it's good or bad species, you will have more cover, period. You will. Whether it's a junky species, like let's say multiflora rose or something else. I'm not advocating to go in and cut and open it up if you know you have multiflora rose. I'm just saying, even if you have that bad species, you have more cover. Then you go in, you treat the multiflora rose, and you move on. But here's the thing. You're not going to get good cover unless you cut, unless you open up the canopy. You're not.
Yeah.
What's going to change? Nothing. We're sitting here talking about the Prairie Hollow property that has only grown up taller, more thick, closed off canopy in 30 years. Nothing had been cut. It didn't get any thicker. It went the other way. So you have to do something. If you want to add cover and go in and cut. Do it. There's no excuses of well, I'm waiting around for all this and that. Like, go in and cut. You guys, we went in and cut in areas that you guys are going to have a timber harvest on down the road. We didn't cut, like, really valuable species or anything.
We left
a lot of that. But...
And the other thing is you don't cut the young stuff that's going to be valuable in the future either.
Yeah, basically there's a vlog that'll come out here in a little bit. We walked you through exactly what we cut, why we cut it, and why we left this standing. Like, there's no excuses of basically not to do it. It's just roll up your sleeves, put some gas, borrow a chainsaw, and run it.
So, through all our
ramblings,
24 minutes of rambling. So far, we've covered things to do before season gets here. Edge feathering.
Check.
Bedding thickets.
Check.
If you're in an area, and guys in crop country, and you're saying, well, when are you going to get to the stuff for me? It's coming. For you timber country guys, and even you guys in crop country that have woodlots, if you can see, or you're going, man, you know, when October hits, I can see 200 yards through there. Do something. Edge feather it, or edge feather the side of the field or the pasture, whatever it is, edge feathered. And then also get in there and cut out a bedding thicket. Make it a half acre.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing with edge feathering is don't just pick the first tree along the edge. If it's junk timber 10, 20 yards into the interior, 30 yards, why are you going to leave that if you got a chainsaw right there in your hand?
Yeah, sawtooth it.
Cut it.
Picture it like a lake, not Okeechobee Lake either.
Yeah.
Lake of the Ozarks, right. or some of the other lakes, Bull Shoals, Table Rock. I'm going to list some local lakes for you. If you look at the coastline, it goes, it's just jagged.
It's lobed everywhere.
And picture that with edge feathering. That's what we're looking for. Chase those trees that aren't providing a lot of benefit or are overstocked and start cutting them out.
Someone's also going to say this just real quick. Well, if I put all that great cover adjacent to my food plot, my deer are going to bed there. Oh, well, then you have crappy open
timber through
the rest of your timber. You need to go into a bedding thicket off the food plot, put them there, let them work out.
Yep. And just by nature of a white-tailed deer, it's probably not going to spend its life bedded right next to a food plot.
No.
There's a transition in there that it's going to have to do. It's got to work off those calories somehow, right? So next thing for you crop field guys, and you're like, what can I do to improve my hunting but also improve my deer herd? We're not going to say habitat because this isn't necessarily a habitat improvement. It's more to improve the health of your deer herd.
Correct.
And your hunting.
And soil.
And that goes, what we're talking about is cover cropping. Now we would love it if you took your 200-acre crop field and you cover cropped it. But we're advocating more on doing 1 to 2 acre cover crops in some of your areas where, let's say you even just have permission to hunt on a farm and the guy has crop fields. Talk to him about adding cover crops to some of your favorite areas. Maybe there's a back corner of a crop field that you're like, well, that's where the deer come out when they're going in this huge cut crop field.
Mm-hmm.
Cover crop that acre to where you have food available, more food available throughout that hunting season, and most importantly through that very stressful period of late winter, early spring, when it's just a crop field that gets cut and they're eating spilled grain, a lot of that's going to be ate up or spoiled by the time late winter, early spring gets here. So cover cropping is a great way to help supplement some of that food availability for the deer, as well as protect some soil by preventing erosion, but also feeding the microbial activity in the soil.
Which no farmer is going to be like, oh, no, don't you dare cover crop that field, son. Like, that is a huge win-win from a hunter getting access into property. Say, hey, not only do I want to hunt it, but here's what I'm willing to do kind of for you. It's going to help us both out. Here are the benefits. Who else is doing that?
And it might he may be going, well, what are you planning on planting? Well, just tell him, maybe it's crimson clover, purple top turnips, and winter wheat. Maybe it's just those three. it's a start.
It's a start. The hope is you learn about cover crops and you learn about diversity. Well, they'll hear it on the other podcast this week about the different blends stuff with Stratton, but all the benefits of diversity. But just get out there and start it. Try it. They're annuals. You can broadcast these things. You don't need heavy equipment. Just get out there and do it. I love October, November, and December because we're hunters at heart. But, man, when you travel and you travel across the country, it's disheartening to see so many acres just bare soil.
Bare ground.
Gosh, it's like, it's tough to see. But there's no excuse for it if you can go out there as a hunter and improve hunting, improve the quality of deer, improve the health of the soil. It's a win-win-win.
Yep, and I'll say something too. If you're looking, if you're in an area where you complain about winter kill, and your crop fields are turned up dirt, stop.
Yeah,
this is one way to help prevent large, massive winter kills is cover cropping. Another thing is exactly what we said on first point and point one and two, woody browse.
Yep.
Think about the two big stressful times of a deer's life. You've got late winter, early spring, and you've got late summer. What can you do to help a deer during late winter, early spring? If there were no crops, if there were no food plots, we're going pre-settlement. What was a lot of the forage available at that point? Woody browse.
Woody browse.
And so,
we're never going to change that. We have to embrace that. Like that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. That's why we always talk about shrubs. That's why we talk about cutting. That's why we talk about flush cutting. Young forest regeneration. It's critical not only for deer, but it's critical for ruffed grouse. Like so many different things. It's a natural part of the landscape that we have forgotten about, and it's critical. And if you want to, coming off the heels of an extremely tough winter, how many people north of us, let's say northern Indiana, north Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, how many people in that massive Arctic blast had deer die in their area? Yes, that was absolutely extreme conditions, but if you didn't have a food source and food was lacking during that period, or quality cover was lacking in that time frame when that Arctic blast hit, deer died.
Yes.
Deer died. And what they need, though, during those times is woody browse. They need to be able to feed.
Add woody browse, add cover crops, and you're going to help your deer herd during that late winter, early spring. 1, 2, 3, point 1, 2, 3, we just helped you out. I will address what can you do to help your deer herd during that stressful period of the summer months. Add natives.
Diversity.
Add diversity of natives.
But guess what? You're going to get that by doing one
sunlight,
and two.
Yes. Yeah, you'll get that by doing one and two. So I guess there is a reason why to mention it. But also, helping deer during that late summer stress period is important as well. So that's where natives come in. When your soybean leaves are turning up, you're trying to get – you're like, man, please just rain. You look over at some common ragweed, and it's just green and lush, and you're like, what in the world is that doing?
Smiling back at
you. Or giant ragweed.
Gosh, they crushed it last year.
And
during our dry spell. Crushed
and so it's like, well,
jewel weed's another one during that time frame, because it's usually bottom ground.
I was looking
ground.
At that while I was bush hogging at the edge of brushy bottom, and it was what time? About noon when I got there. You could see water droplets all over it.
And when you go and you break that stem, it's like when you cut into an orange or a tomato, you're like, oh, I don't want it to squirt in my eye.
Yeah.
There's so much moisture in that stem. They're going in there and they absolutely hammer it during those times.
For sure.
Now, we probably ought to get you brush hogging in August time frame. We better get to that because someone's like, what, they did what?
Yeah.
Let's just hold on.
Cover crops. So we're going to – the next one is add diversity. So we've talked about crop fields. If you're a guy that's got food plots and you planted corn and you're like, this is going to be my late season dynamite spot, or I've got standing beans – You've got standing beans, standing corn, or something, and you're like Milo. Even you're like, this is going to be late season honey hole, and it's a monoculture or it's just a lot of grain. You're like, here, this is what I'm hunting. If you're like us and you planted soybeans, you're like, this is going to be standing soybeans late winter. We're going to get that cold front during muzzleloader season, and it's going to be game on. and then it stays warm and warm and warm, and it's a very mild winter, early part of the winter, and you're like, they're never going to get to the beans. It's never been cold enough for them to get to the beans. And you're like, dang, I wonder what I could have done. Here's what you could have done. You could have done the same thing we talked about in the crop field. Add diversity by cover cropping those 1 or 2 acre, maybe 5 acre grain fields. Adding diversity to it is not only going to help fight off weeds in the future, especially in the spring when you get those winter annual weeds, but you're also going to make sure that there's a food source there no matter what weather condition. Whether it's a mild winter or a very cold winter, you got the benefit of food. So you can definitely, definitely help your deer herd, but also help your soil and help your chances at punching a tag in that food plot by adding diversity. If you've got standing grain, put greens below it.
You got to. And greens is a general term, but it's including all the fall annuals we talk about here in the podcast with the guys at Stratton Seed. Like, listen to that podcast, listen to the factors of diversity, what they play, what they do, and you'll understand why you want that in a food plot regime or in a native mindset across your whole property. Diversity is the only thing that's going to truly get you ahead and let your property in a general neighborhood stance stand out in the manner that you want it to. Diversity. You're going to shine. When other people are just
not only
drowning in their
not
swabbles.
Only diversity in natives, but diversity in non-natives with the food plot species.
Yeah.
So, next one. Now we're getting back to the brush hogging. Were we brush hogging? And it's weed control in clover. So, we have a clover field we call Brushy Bottom that we planted the Stratton Revival blend in it last September, I believe, first week of September.
Yep.
And then we also frost seeded again in March. And it is red clover, white clover, I think it's ladino clover, alfalfa, and chicory. So 4 species that we then planted triticale and wheat. In it. The wheat did really good. So we basically had 5 species in that food plot through the fall, winter, and spring. And now we here are in summer. So I want you guys to all picture how much maintenance you've done on your food plot areas in the last year. So if you planted your food plots last fall, how many times have you mowed them or sprayed clethodim, a grass-specific herbicide, or gone and got 2,4-DB or Raptor or any of these herbicides to try and control the weeds in your clover plots? How many times have you done that? And then try to account for your time and money you spent on that.
Don't make yourself sick thinking about it.
Yeah, and so we're using, I even think there's a study where they found it lower to forage or something. It wasn't like successful
mowing.
But mowing.
Correct.
But
that's true.
I've done mowing on clovers for years and years and years, and I feel like it is the best way to control weeds. Now, if you have a lot of weeds, that's a whole other problem. But if you're just general maintenance for me, and my example is we had foxtail millet that was a problem. We had Cerisa lespidiza just kind of scattered. I pulled a lot of the sprigs, and then there was a couple other species that I don't even remember what they were, but they were trying to come up. And they hadn't made seed yet. They were working on it, but it probably wasn't mature yet. So we mowed, and I clipped it. And it was basically, you know, that plant has devoted all its energy into making those seeds, and I clipped it before it was mature, so it's not going to have time to grow back.
And produce a viable seed this year. So you got rid of, for the most part, a potential expanding problem just by mowing. So it's a way to avoid herbicides if you're into that. But the thing is, like, identify what the trouble is. It's not the most simple answer, but everyone wants just to flat out kill stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, what is the species? What is the problem? You don't go mow it early. Wait for it to get to that stage where it starts to develop and put its energy into the seed head, and then come back and mow it later into the season. So even if it does grow back some, it's not going to have time to produce a seed head.
And a lot of these are annuals.
Doesn't matter. Yeah.
And basically, we're going from a seed to trying to germinate, put a roots in, and grow while we have established perennials of clover, alfalfa, that are going to out-compete it, because they're just going to, as soon as the first little rain or heavy dews we get a couple mornings, it's already going to blow back, and it's going to be
perfect. This morning, I bet it was cool in that little bottom, and it's just sitting perfect.
Yeah, so much humidity.
Something degrees when I woke up this morning.
When we got out there, when we hung that set not too far from there, do you remember walking into that going, oh, my gosh, it feels like a stinking greenhouse. It's so humid and hot. Because there's so much moisture in that clover and alfalfa, and then you have the heat. It's just trying to – it was just like a sauna.
Mm-hmm.
And that's – we know there's a lot of moisture below that clover and alfalfa and chicory. So,
well, we've gone out there middle of the day this summer and just kind of dug around and kind of like, you know, looking at the thickness of the clover and everything. And there's so much moisture at the ground level just right there.
Yeah.
And it's incredible.
So – weed control and clover, we bush hogged. So when we planted last September, we didn't touch it all the way till this past Friday, 2 days ago. We came back in and clipped it. Now, what we'll probably do is look for the next good rain, and we'll run down and broadcast wheat or trid kale or even one of these fall mixes from Stratton, Bounty Hunter, or Cattleman's Treasure. We'll broadcast
that. Something that's heavier on the grain.
Yep, we'll broadcast that. Before the rain and broadcast it at a high C rate, and we'll have success. And that is our way to control weeds and clovers, by adding other species that aren't legumes to the mix. So you've
Correct.
Got alfalfa, you've got red clover, and you've got ladino clover, all three legumes that fixate nitrogen as they're growing. Now, that over the years, anybody who's ever planted clover, first year, my gosh, it was dog hair thick of clover. Next year, still great. Next year, maybe still great, a few weeds. Next year, a little more weeds. Next year, even more weeds. And you're like, okay, why? It's just, I can't get that long term. It's because you've planted legumes, nothing but legumes. And nature, over time, is going to equalize itself. It's going to fix the problem. It's going to add diversity. And so you're basically, by adding these other cereal grains or broadleaves to the mix, you're helping
recreate
nature's
there.
Natural process, and you're getting to pick what grows there rather than nature choosing what grows there. So this is a great way to help combat weeds in your perennial clover plots. So mowing, and then also following that up, broadcasting at a heavy rate. If it's wheat, you're trying to broadcast at 100 pounds per acre, and you're doing that right before rain. Now, piggybacking off that, we have what other things you can do this time of year to help make sure you have successful hunts and successful herds in the future, and also limit time is another thing. That's what this one, planning long-term plots. If you're in an area, how many times do we get this question? I've got this smaller area, it may be quarter or half acre, but it's got some trees around it, so it's kind of shaded. What's the best thing I can plant? Well, it's probably not going to be soybeans, probably not going to be corn, because you said one of the key phrases, partially shaded, and it's a smaller area. So we already know it's more shaded than what you're leading on, because it's only a small area.
Yeah,
and if it's got trees around it, it's got a lot of shade.
No. It probably has trees scattered throughout it still.
Probably, yes. And so
– got them.
Planting a shade-tolerant species like – perennial clovers and chicory is a great thing you can do. So, like we said, if you're establishing, if you have one of these areas that's a new food plot or it's a spot that you've struggled to get stuff to grow, soil test first, seeing what hopefully you're working to get the soil correct. But at the same time, you plant a species like the Stratton Revival. It's got red clover, white clover, chicory. And then also adding in those nurse crops, those oats or wheat, to try and help that along, but also get established and protect those really young clovers and broadleaves, because they're perennial, so they're going to work on their roots a little bit longer than your annuals like your wheat would. So the wheat's going to jump, and it's going to take a little bit longer for those perennials to get their roots and then jump. So that's what you do. Then next spring, if you've got it, if it's a little bit weaker in areas, you can add buckwheat or in the February, March, frost seed. But plant long-term perennial plots in areas that are more shade tolerant, or if you're trying to limit the amount of work and maintenance you have to do throughout the year.
Yeah, if you're a guy who's sitting back and like, listen, guys, I've been focusing on food plots for years and years and years and years on my property, and I want to do what you guys are talking about, focus on the native habitat, do work in my timber, old field management, native plantings, this and that. Start to convert some of your existing food plot acres into perennial stands, and therefore you reduce the maintenance time you have to work on those and can then focus on the things you want to focus on. There's a balance in all of it, but just reorganizing your time and your resources is going to go a long ways in basically getting you close to your goals on your property, diversifying it.
That's right.
What we got next?
Next one is mowing lanes. Did this just 2 days ago.
That was another reason for the brush hog.
Yep. You know, one of the few reasons.
Yeah. But, you know, there's places that have, you know, overgrown pastures or old fields.
Yeah. Or prairies. What can you do to help steer deer more? And this is where we mowing lanes. It could be putting in shooting lanes for rifle hunting. If you've got really, really thick switchgrass, think of all the people that have fallen victim to switchgrass monocultures. And they realize just how thick it is. And once it gets mature, where deer really don't like walking through that thick, rank grass. Well, mowing lanes is a great way. And so if you've got, they're going to take the path of least resistance, just like a lot of us would. And so if you have these thick areas and you're trying to, man, how can I get them to come by the stand? Hook up the bush hog or, even just drive a four-wheeler multiple times across an area and knock that grass down to where it's a little bit easier to walk through. They're going to choose that. And that's one thing we like to do.
We cut out a different little trail walking path to and from stands that we hadn't really used in probably been years. But it's just thinking about the access, and those trails can benefit the deer and move them closer to a stand or out in the open more, whatever it may be. But understanding your access and utilizing that mow trail for you too, your purpose of in and out of the property, goes a long ways. You get in quicker, you get in quieter, and so don't forget about that this time of the year. We talk a ton of managing the land, but simple things like that, what you spent, who knows how long or how many linear feet you mowed across the place for that reason the other day, but it's like half a day.
I spent more time mowing trails than I did mowing lanes for deer to walk down.
Yeah, I mean it's a hour, 2 hour thing is all that it takes across a decent sized property to knock out and help you this
fall. Yes, and also I did, you know, I'm going to skip one and we'll circle back to it because it goes more of something we talked about earlier, but access is a huge, huge thing that you should be working on year round and thinking about year round.
I will say this: you won't improve as a hunter on a property if you do not consider and constantly reevaluate your access to a property.
Yeah, for
great,
sure.
Great story from the other night. It was 8 o'clock when we were trying to connect some dots on some deer movement, and this place that we found is on an access route, the main one into the property. How many times have we driven past that and just never really looked at it and understood that that could be a place to kill one of the biggest deer on the property right now?
For sure. Absolutely. It's one of those things that it's probably always evolving. It's always changing, and you should be always, if you're doing habitat improvements every single year, you're going to shift travel patterns. You're going to shift the way deer maneuver through a property.
For sure.
So you're always tweaking. But access is one of those things that, how many times, if you're a Land and Legacy client, if you've hired us for our consultation services, plug your ears or stop listening for a second. How many times do we ask this question to
there
somebody?
There went all of our listeners.
or friends, and we say, boy, this does look like a good spot. How do you get here? And they say,
oh, Lordy. Well, that's the thing.
That's when we go, okay, we got a problem. Bing, ding, 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 light bulb. We have a problem. We need to fix that. And fixing that problem is not hey, well, I just have my buddy drive me in or my son drive me in here, and then he comes and picks me up. That's a Band-Aid on a wound that's a big wound. It's only temporary, and it's really not the best option. We need to figure out, and it could be solved, if that's the case, it could be solved by improving bedding or making actual bedding.
Concentrating deer.
Concentrating the bedding area or making a significant bedding area. It may be making a food plot better, a feeding area better.
Making a better funnel in an area.
Maybe it's making a better funnel. There's all kinds of ways to solve that problem. We don't know what it's going to be until we get there.
But I'll tell you this, we're gonna address it,
problem when somebody says, I don't know. It's like when they say that, I automatically picture it's 30 minutes before daylight and they're walking in and deer are scattering everywhere. At some point, that's happened. So we got to fix that problem.
Real quick, we need to do a podcast of the things that, like, every property that we go to, the landowner will say at some point.
That one's a little bit dangerous, but they're going to – but a little side note, they're going to point out those persimmon trees.
Yes, they will.
And so, you know, and we love all our clients, and it's fun.
Oh, absolutely.
And we're there to help them.
100%.
And it's kind of that all shucks when you ask them, because it's like they've listened to the podcast. They know
we're gonna
pounce on that one.
Yeah. And I know some of them are chuckling right now.
It might as well go hand in hand if you ask, okay, where did the deer come from when you're in this one? Well, they pretty much come from everywhere.
From every direction.
I feel like Jeff Foxworthy, he's got a joke where he goes through the whole thing and he says, that's the sign.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it is on that one. Well, that's a sign. It's in the wrong place.
Yeah.
It may be a great spot, but it's not the best spot because you're spooking deer, even though they may not be blowing or you may not see them run, you're still alerting deer. So we're going to get around that. And so access is crucial. If you find a great spot, it better have great access.
It's not a great spot until it has great access. And you might need to create that access. But until then, it's a potential great spot.
And I mean, just things to consider. If it is a great spot, probably the most important thing is the tree's going to suck.
Yeah.
Because they never go hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah.
You're always in the best spots have the worst trees.
I could make that work. I'd prefer not to, but that's my only option.
Or it's covered in poison ivy.
Yeah.
Then I
go hang it.
Yeah, and so, and then I'll gripe the whole time that it's set up for a righty.
Yeah, exactly. Luckily, I don't get poison ivy.
And so that's pretty much, access. So that could be right now, instead of cutting across the field, that's the path that's the least resistance, it's easy, it's nice, it's the shortest distance. Maybe it means you got to get in that ditch and walk that ditch up to the stand.
Go in with chainsaw
or creek or whatever it is, find the best path, whether it's a zigzag or it's got a big bend and instead of a straight line, maybe it's a bended path. Find the best access to where you're going to alert the least amount of deer and hopefully no deer, and make that path to where it's easy to walk. So if it is a ditch, cut some trees out of it. If it is a ditch, cut the brush out of it.
How many stands have we walked that are in the creek bed?
A lot. That's my favorite approach. If you're in terrain country, going up a little ravine that's
right
going
at the gut. Right up it.
And it may be a 30-yard walk, I'm thinking the newsstand, or a 40-yard walk that's steep as a horse's face.
Yep.
Rather than walking an extra 20 yards up the creek to then walk to the top of the cut or top of the little ravine and walking down it. There's a greater chance of spooking deer, so we're going to go straight up that steep.
Let's say this. I would much rather sweat my way into a stand that has incredible access, knowing I'm not going to spook any deer, and I'm going to hunt it on the right winds, where if I do sweat a little bit, I'm not too worried about it, then going the long way around and bumping deer going to that stand.
Absolutely. So access. If you're going through a field, maybe you mow a trail, so you're not wading through grass and leaving scent everywhere. If it's through the timber and you're going up a ravine, cut out the... Move the rocks around. I think of a couple this spring turkey hunting. I can think of a time where I stepped on a big rock and it was like, and it made a lot of noise. Remove those. Move them over to where they don't make noise. Walk that out. You should have been walking this out a month ago, but if it's never too late, make sure that access is set up correctly.
I don't,
got anything else to add on access?
Again, I honestly, there's tons of places you can kill deer on a well managed or set up farm. Truthfully, if it's done right and the resources are in the right places, you can kill them hopefully in two or three places. And so I don't get caught up necessarily on the tree it's at, because I know there's somewhere else that I should be able to kill this deer too. I'm more focused on access, that I want this deer to continue to do what he's been doing and will do. And so I don't want to screw it up by bumping him. I'm going to wait to the right day, wait for the right conditions, wait for the right access, and go in and kill it. I think it's a combination of a great location, impeccable access, and then just being patient enough to know when not to hunt it and when to hunt it. It's the balance of those three things that I think makes a great stand. And a lot of it, again, it's not just a location. It's all those things put together.
If you're a public land hunter, the guys that talk land habitat are talking public land.
I'll bet you
access is the biggest way. It was for me. Access was always the way to be most successful. Everybody, you're competing with other hunters. They're walking in the path of least resistance, the easiest way. And yet that may be the way that walks right by the deer's, the deer's bedding area, or the area that they're feeding. Access, access, access. How many times can we preach access, diversity, and natives?
Hunting strategy, there's not a better thing to preach than access. And truthfully, the one that we found, that other stand location the other night, is awesome.
Amazing access.
It's perfect.
It's going to set up great for a rifle hunter.
No, that's okay. Or black powder when they're going down to the bottom.
Yep.
Crossing. I mean, it's going to be awesome.
All right.
What's next?
Last thing, going back to food plots, I wanted to talk about red clover. That was a big thing in your perennial food plots. Red clover kind of gets dogged some.
I was going to say.
Because it's stemmy is what people will say. And it's one of those things that's like, well, it's real stemmy. It doesn't put off as much tonnage. I don't know where that comes from. When you look at Ladino clover, it's real short. Puts off, it's mainly leaves. It's not as stemmy. But you look at red clover, it's stemmy. It's twice as tall, but there's leaves in multiple places.
Yeah,
so
all
it probably,
across the stem.
It produces great tonnage. But here's the reason why I wanted to mention it and why it's on the bottom, because it was a final thought I had before we wrap this up, and I was working on the notes. You look at Ladino clover, and we talked about this pre-show. It peaks at the same time a lot of cool seasons peak, right around turkey season. It peaks in that April, May, and it's still producing in June, and can in July if you're getting rain. But thing about white clover is it peaks at a different time as red clover. So if you combine the two, you're going to have two peaks of production at different times of the growing season. So one will peak in May, one will peak in probably June, July. Red clover is right now is peaking. I mean, it is tall,
it's
tons of forage. Pollinators are using it like crazy. But if you look at it, it's like, man, this thing's going nuts while Ladino's kind of tapering off. And so if you're like, I love my white clover, look at adding red clover, because it's going to peak at a different time. And probably you're going to carry that peak performance throughout the whole summer rather than just early summer and then just hope like crazy you get rain and you get moisture during later on in the summer, so your white clover stays active and stays growing and doesn't go dormant.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same thing really that can be said with the alfalfa, is it handles the middle of the summer way far better than your white clover. So if you want to have a truly perennial feeding plot that has benefits throughout the almost every single month of the year, depending on your climate and your location, you've got to have the diversity, and hitting those peaks of late May, June, into July, red clover kills it, and then alfalfa's going from late April all the way through the summer and into the fall. You just have to have the balance. You have to have those other species to balance it out. And red clover, like you said, one that has been forgotten in the wildlife world, but truthfully, it is a great forage and hits another window that we need to be conscious of. That's,
you know,
when antlers are
we
growing.
We must be the most honest guys out there. You know why? Because you're always
why.
Truthfully, and I'm always to be honest.
Truthfully? Honestly?
Oh, man. Just crack me up because I know people have commented on some of our phrases we use over and over.
Yeah.
Now, we've shifted out of dive in
and
can of worms, and now we're into, I'll be honest with you, and
truthfully. I wonder what the next ones are going to bring.
I don't know.
I'm scared.
What can you do this time of year preparing for deer season? It's right around the corner. You can still edge feather, and I would encourage you to do so. You can still create bedding thickets. You can prepare for cover cropping in those crop fields. You can prepare for cover cropping or adding diversity to your standing grain fields. So if you have standing soybeans, you have standing corn, add some cover crops or some greens, some brassicas, some annual clover, some wheat, some cereal rye. Add those to it so you have something on the food plot for warmer weather or colder weather. You have weed control and clover. So cut the, if you've got some clovers, clover plots, and you have some weeds in them, and they're almost going to seed, go ahead and clip them. Make sure that those weeds don't go to seed. Then throw down some cereal grains to try to help add diversity and take care of some of that nitrogen that clover and those other legumes have fixated all growing season. You also have planting. If you're looking at your food plot program, add, if your soybeans, or your soybeans and cowpeas and lab and all these other things, add some perennial clovers, some perennial mixes with alfalfa, chicory, and different clovers to the mix. Mowing lanes. So you've got mowing lanes out through your grassy overgrown fields, your CRP fields.
Yeah.
Yeah, mow some lanes to where you have, and that's just one pass with a 5-foot mower or whatever. Just a
simple,
little bitty
don't
simple thing.
It.
Don't make a 30-foot band. Don't overdo it. Keep it small. Keep it simple, stupid. Right? That's the phrase. Add red clover, and then also nail down access. So make sure your access trails are cleared out and you have those trails cleared out. So all those, do them. You won't regret it. Not this season, not next season, not 5 years from now, especially if you're doing edge feathering, bedding thickets, and adding diversity.
I would say, don't stink and complicate stuff. Stop overthinking it and get out there and do it. Yes, things are dynamic, but you're not going to see change unless you change and you change the landscape in a positive way. Everyone's smart. Just use common sense and get out there and make the differences that you want to see. You have to take action to do that. And then two, shoot your bow.
Shoot your bow, yeah.
That's another big one for preparation. I'm saying that to remind myself because I haven't done it yet.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Me either.
That needs to happen.
We're wrapping it up now. One thing that's totally off topic, but it's a reminder for you guys, and Matt will know where this is coming from based on our church service this morning. But this fall, it's not about killing the biggest deer in the neighborhood, but it's important, and most importantly, to be a good dad, be a good husband. So, guys, don't forget to focus on priorities. That's
100%.
The most important thing that we can tell you and that you can
take away
is if there comes a time this fall where you're like, should I hunt, should I not? If there comes a time to be a good dad or you can take your kid, do it. You won't regret it. And just don't forget to focus on habitat's great, but it's more important to be a good dad, be a good husband, be a good person.
That's exactly right.
All right, guys. We'll see you next week.
See you.